You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
You know, it's kind of interesting because in the last couple of weeks, it just so happens that more than not, we've been talking about sharks. And not only did the Discovery Channel have their Shark Week thing, but we had a couple of shark bites here. One was a tourist lady, and really, really nice lady, and she thought it was a tiger shark. Turns out it wasn't. It was more likely a white tip. And it just dawned on me that we haven't gotten together and talked about sharks for a while. And one of the good things we can do is with Mark Fitchett is talk about it, because he's the pelagic fisheries ecosystem scientist for the council, and also loves pelagics and loves sharks. So we're going to spend a little bit of time on something that's pretty important, and that is, believe it or not, the necessity of spending some time helping these sharks regrow. You know, are there enough of them in the sea, and where are we standing with all of that, and what's their threat and all of that? So it's an interesting thing that it took somebody coming literally from the opposite end of the globe that you did, Mark, to find your way to Hawaii. But I guess there are some similarities. What's your fascination like I have with sharks?
Well, sharks are interesting because they have different reproductive capacity of than like tunas and billfishes, which my favorite, you know, fish, obviously, sure, we discussed are the billfish. But sharks are interesting because they have a historical impact on the ecosystem through millions of years. They're an apex predator. They're sort of they cull a lot of populations of lower trophic level fish, and they keep things at an equilibrium. So they play a very, very huge role in that component. And also, you know, when you're assessing sharks, because they're not necessarily a target species all the time, it takes a lot of forensics, yeah, on data, doing a lot of data forensics to come up with ways to estimate their or assess the populations.
And that's fascinating to me too, because I do know that we have some pretty improvingly better scientific ways to do stock assessments, you know, particularly like, say, of tuna or mai mai or your pelagics or reef fish. It's pretty easy to do a pretty good count. But those of us that know a little bit more about sharks, there are the jury is still out on exactly how many of them there are. And I guess for a while, there's some parts of the world that think they can just keep taking them there. They replenish like tuna. They apparently don't.
Yeah, and that brings 2 points I like to make. You know, when you assess sharks, there's a great uncertainty in the catch history. One of the issues that the stock assessment that was conducted in 2012 had was with the data that went up to 2009. There was a lot of uncertainty in the catch history because there was a targeting effect. Mm-hmm. And so as we progress in doing these, like I mentioned earlier, these data forensics of how we can reconstruct what is the likely catch of sharks, and that is oftentimes due to another issue, which is the underreported and illegal fishing that is going on in the Western Central Pacific.
Yeah, and we're all aware of that, but there's one question that always comes up, and that is, there are certain parts of the world where shark is consumed regularly. I mean, it's a food fish, you know, and I do know that there was a rule once here. If you're going to bring in a shark fin, you're going to bring in the whole shark.
Bring in the whole shark. Yeah, yeah. There are some prohibitions on just retaining just the fins. Mm-hmm. And in many, many parts of the world, you know, and just for the listeners out there, you know, especially in China and in Asia, fins are used as in soups. Because there's belief that there is some sort
of... Well, they're an aphrodisiac or whatever. Yeah. But the thing is, when those rumors prosper, the sharks get nervous because they get, I mean, there's something about it. And I guess then the romance part of it comes into it, where I know a place where you can get the best, but it's $50 a bowl, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it actually become, in addition to a thought of aphrodisiac, a delicacy.
Yeah. And sort of the way, and yeah, exactly. And there's this demand that boomed. And so, you know, a lot of people, and from the public perception, you know, they look at fisheries as a whole being the contributor to the demise of sharks due to shark finning and the shark fin demand, when in reality, a lot of people, even in the fisheries sector, find it quite, you know, repugnant. And
I see that a lot, by the way.
And so here in Hawaii, there's been a prohibition on finning for two decades, and so finning doesn't really, in our, especially in our longline fisheries, is not necessarily an issue, or is not an issue, because there's been a no retention of white tip sharks for a while, and finning has been essentially abolished, and we also, in our fisheries here in Hawaii, in our shallow set swordfish fishery, we have 100% observer coverage, and
that bears repeating. 100%
observer coverage in the shallow set longline fishery for swordfish,
meaning they are totally supervised and watched,
right? You have 20% in the deep set longline fishery, and then on top of that, the fishery has been very receptive, and we've actually been working with some of our partners in the fishing industry on developing ways to reduce the interactions with sharks, because, you know, sharks can, if you're having interactions with sharks, it can be, it can actually create issues on retaining catch of target species due to depredation and stuff like that. So there's not an incentive for our fisheries to interact with sharks. In fact, interacting with sharks is actually a bad thing that both the fishery, but also the conservationists are coming together to come up with ways to reduce the interactions of sharks.
I've always thought of a shark as being a very necessary part of the ecosystem, in that it was a janitor, you know, in many respects.
The garbage man.
Yeah, you know, and there's no way to really capture the worth of that until it wasn't there. When you find out where there's a whole bunch of garbage, where there is no predation, it gets to be a pretty big problem.
Right, and there's been lots of studies by both. There's been no doubt that sharks play an ecological role in controlling the trophic level, especially in reef environments. Even my colleagues and more in the environmental realm and shark experts, that we can find some common ground and that we need sharks. They are an important component of the ecosystem that we need to protect.
Well, remember just a few months back, they got a bunch of guys trying to leave the airport with suitcases full of shark fins. It just goes to show you that there are people that are willing to take a risk of it being caught because of the reward.
And I want to make it very clear, and I'm glad you brought that up. When that came out, the media, the local media, did not clarify that these were Indonesian nationals. There's 20 of them who bought suitcases of shark fins, and these were these were fishermen who were on Japanese vessels and foreign vessels that were using Hawaii as a port of entry, and they were intercepted by Hawaii officials and
by
US
some
officials.
Intelligence is what happened
intel and angered even those in the fishing community here, because when you have things like this, when the playing field of compliance and following the rules is not even, it angers a lot of our fishing community here in Hawaii, and it should anger those on the conservation front.
Well, you're 100% right. And gang, if you've been following me and you've been following the Buck Stops Here magazine article that I do with Hawaii Boats and Yachts, we just spent a lot of time on that very subject, and that is the responsibility of watching people with lay nets and the wholesale damage they can do, and knowing that there is somewhere to report it, because I'm not going to follow the rule if you can blatantly see somebody else ignoring it. And that's what makes our sword fishery so unique, in that every single boat is supervised and monitored. They can't step one foot out of line, and yet there's somebody 40 miles away that are doing what they want.
Yeah, so outside the EEZ, and that brings up a good point, is right now, at present, 83% of Hawaii's EEZ is closed to fishing.
Yep.
Which is
unheard of. That's a lot.
And some of the arguments that in my opinion, and also, and I wouldn't necessarily say opinion, I think it's fact, is that these closures are a result of the compliance of the fishery themselves. Mm-hmm. When in reality, outside these EEZs, you have foreign fleets that are essentially do not have the compliance monitoring, yeah. the electronic reporting, the observer coverage that we have, and that yeah. who are taking at wholesale value many, many more times the volume of protected yeah. species interactions that sure. we have here in Hawaii. And that needs to be
very
noted.
Scary. Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Okay. So, but let's talk about the big picture though, with the white tips, because every bit of research, what you're talking to me is some of this research is saying that, all right, you get to a point where you need to identify that there is a problem. And with regards to population, are we there?
Well, to answer that question, are we there? Well, we don't know, mm-hmm. and which is the problem in itself,
yeah.
because these are data deficient stocks. And let me just tell you that in the last stock assessment, the author of that assessment was actually here this week, and he's a brilliant scientist, and he pointed out that at the time, 10 years ago, they were dealing with data that had high levels of uncertainty. And based on that assessment, if you were to take the modeling parameters from that assessment and feed them forward with what we perceive as estimated catches, that yeah. stock would technically be exterminated by now, would be close
yeah,
to extirpated.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's even in that assessment, which showed a very, very... somber outlook on the stock.
Yeah, yeah.
Even that, there is some gross inaccuracies on that, and then also with the biomass estimates. However, there is unequivocal.
Yeah.
It is unequivocal that the stock is below a or the population itself mm-hmm. globally is below a threshold that is necessarily maximize or has a maximal reproductive capacity, and that is that's a problem. There's been yeah. serious depletion, and as we mentioned earlier, the species has been listed under the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah, so, now in many respects, there would be people in certain other areas which would be fighting to reverse that, to get it off of that. And I'm not just saying the white-tipped shark. I'm talking about other things too that they try to say. Hey, there's plenty. Let's delist them.
Yeah,
it takes a lot to delist something because you really have to be able to show
right.
a recovery.
It is easier to list something than it is to delist them. But the species, but the species was listed globally as endangered because it was assumed in the listing itself that you have two distinct population groups. Although within those population groups, you could actually have separate populations amongst themselves, was the Atlantic and then the Indo-Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of the catch data, the catch rates that have emerged, which we'll get to that in a moment, the catch rates were used to kind of be a proxy for the depletion of the species mm-hmm. globally.
Globally,
and,
yeah.
and that's an issue. And due to the shark fin trade and the uncertainty of catches and also with compliance, there was a petition to have them listed. So we had a workshop this week that was hosted and put together that was here in Hawaii and Waikiki that folks from National Marine Fisheries Service in D.C. and a shark scientist at the Southeast Science Center in Florida came over, and we had a recovery plan with experts from fishing industry. We had some academics from here in Hawaii. We also had the fishing community. We had conservationists, and then we have the policy folks from D.C. here.
That's a lot of yin and yang, right?
Yeah, we had a lot, but
lots of opinions.
But yeah. We did. But you know, I think there was some consensus in there. The consensus was that this is largely an international issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the issue was also, how do we identify threat criterion? Because the species was listed as threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to come up with thresholds or at least goals
yep.
that be set. And so we're in the very first early stages of that.
Yeah, threatened. By the way, explain that to people who don't know what the levels are.
So there's levels of there's vulnerable, threatened. I honestly don't really
yeah.
know the exact distinctions, but when you start to go into critically endangered and then threatened,
yeah,
those are two different
distinctions. Now you're talking, yeah.
You're thinking it's about to bottom out badly. Yeah. And but the issue is right now is the population has likely stabilized. Mm-hmm. But even though it's below a biomass level that is considered suitable for maximum reproductive output.
You know, some people think like Waikiki, close it for a year, it replenishes. Well, it doesn't.
No.
You know, and it never will. And even that, even if they close it for 5 years, the first week of the new section of 5 years, they catch all the fish.
Right.
So one would think that if you are in the habit of harvesting a certain thing, whether it be a white tip or a marlin, you know, you're going to get to a point where you know where to get them. And as long as you keep getting them, you don't think it possibly is in danger because there they are.
Yeah. And so that brings up a good point on catch rates. So catch rates, and so one thing I brought up at the recovery plan meeting is that we're basing, at least here in the central North Pacific, we're categorizing the depletion of the stock based on catch rates. And catch rates, if you're looking, may not always be a good proxy or indicator of abundance unless you standardize for that.
Okay.
And you take into account other extrinsic factors. And so, for example, here in Hawaii, we may have had a decline in catch rates, but also through time, we've incrementally had regulations to the fishery to reduce the bycatch of these species. Mm. And also, we've had some closures on the Prias, the Monument. We've had closures in the fishery in areas that may have had a higher abundance of sharks. So, therefore, intrinsically, your catch rates are inherently going to decline. So, that information is then being used to categorize the fishery as being depleting the stock.
That's really interesting. One question would come up, and I've heard this from listeners, about Papahanaumokuakea being the apex predator there seems to be the ulua. That there's lots and lots of big ulua, then maybe it's because they're not lots and lots of sharks, you know, and one would think, well, are there? And so I don't know what sort of information we have about how far depleted, you know, these ocean sharks like white tips might be in the monument. For instance, if you have all these big ulua.
Yeah, and I want to add to that, and I'm glad you brought that up. When people bring these type of things, these anecdotal things, oftentimes they can build conjectural arguments that, you know, a management action like a closure is working, or that maybe there has been a depletion of one species when we don't have a baseline.
Yeah,
and I can tell you by spending time in New Caledonia and diving there that they have plenty of sharks and they have plenty of ulua too.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. There is no baseline to compare that to. There's also haven't been done any, at least and coming from a pelagic fishery standpoint, there have been absolutely zero discernible targets or goals, management objectives to these closures. And there's been zero studies to show to use what's called a counterfactual analysis of looking at the impact on the fishery or these pelagic species. Mm-hmm. And so there's been no monitoring and there wasn't. So, you know, that's one thing to take into consideration.
Yeah. You know, here in Hawaii, in the main islands, and I know you've heard this a lot, sharks were pretty much revered and not consumed much. I mean, you know, I'm sure that there were some people that ate, particularly maybe mako sharks and others, but I'm not sure that they've been a menu item. I think they've been more of a religious icon, you know, that where people say, that's my amakua.
Yeah.
I mean, protected by the shark. And there are people in native communities I know throughout the Pacific that revere the sharks, that would certainly never think of killing them.
Yeah, and then, but you know, that's a complex issue, and I think blanket statements on how sharks are perceived and how they are utilized in cultural and socioeconomically, there is no blanket or generalized approach to this. I think every community, island community, as I've learned, is extremely different.
Me too. I've seen mixed opinions in many, many places. Some say you got to kill the sharks because they're taking all our food, you know, so it really does. But the bottom line is that you can't take any species and see it go away without thinking, how is this going to affect the rest of them?
Right. And there's a trickle-down effect. Yeah. So there's a bottom-up effect, obviously, in trophic levels. When you remove one component, it's like sweeping the rug out of the underneath some species. But at the same time, when you knock the top off the trophic level, these small groups of apex predators, they can put populations of other trophic levels, like smaller fish, out of equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and there is...
It doesn't take much, right?
It doesn't take much.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, the humans are also a component in that,
mm-hmm.
and that we, you know, utilize resources for food and for consumption. And so we're also a part of the ecosystem, and that's not, you know, that's not something to forget. But also at the same time, we need to better assess how we are impacting these species based on, you know, unintentional interactions, and also when it comes into the larger play. So we can't, if we're looking at sharks also in just a localized approach, we can run into coming up with some conclusions which may not necessarily be accurate. We're dealing with an international issue here.
Yeah, but what we said is okay. So the problem has been recognized, or theoretically identified. What the problem is: shrinking population. And you're saying a recovery plan,
right.
that's gonna require a lot of cooperation between a lot of people.
Exactly, and that cooperation, and that's one thing that we discussed here at the recovery plan meeting in the last 2 days. We had some fishermen from the Big Island come mm-hmm. in, who are Ikashibi fishermen, Palauis, yeah. trawlers. We had folks from HLA here. We had environmental mm-hmm. groups, and we also had academics. And one thing that we wanted to come up with was we need a bottom-up approach.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a group of fishermen who are contributing to letting scientists come in and tag sharks, to study sharks. The longline fishery here has been open for experimental longline sets mm-hmm. to work with some scientists on reducing the mortality of sharks post-release.
Exactly, yeah.
We had some excellent scientists at the University of Hawaii, mm-hmm. You know, there's some grad students who are there, very bright guys. And then we had a scientist with the Pacific Islands Fishery Science Center, and she's been instrumental in this research. So the fishermen have been providing and have been an access to scientific research. And we wanted to make it clear that, you know, this information that they're helping the scientists garner need to be used, not necessarily to be punitive and regulations, but also to help them, because they don't want to be interacting with these sharks either.
No, and what I found out, that's exactly it. What I found out about it at the local level, that you can get a lot of cooperation from people when you're talking about sharks, because they're either taking their catch or they're worried about getting their kids bitten. So they're only worried about the big bad part of the sharks. But there are some that will tell you, like the maybe not the Paluahi guys, or maybe not the Ikashibi guys, because they don't want to be hauling up this fish and then have the sharks come and take it.
Right.
But it happens. You know, and as long as it keeps happening, you know the sharks are there.
Yeah, and we have a depredation problem in the Marianas Islands and in Guam, and we've been working. Just this week, I had a meeting with Carl Meyer, who's a scientist at the University of Hawaii here, and he's been very instrumental in coming up with innovative techniques as deterrents.
Mm-hmm.
So you have two things: you have reducing the post-release mortality of sharks, ways how can we get them off or mm-hmm. away from the hook. But also, what are ways to deter sharks? And then the third is looking at scientific data, oceanographic information, tagging data, and coming up with a way that we could produce perhaps an adaptive real-time target that fishermen can use as a tool to avoid sharks. And that's a tall order. There's a lot of work.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of work that's got to be done there, right?
But that could be an interesting, but a bottom-up approach to reducing the shark problem and to helping the recovery of the species. It needs to come, you know, we already have a highly compliant and highly regulated fishery here. Ways that we can get the fishing, our community here, and more involved in helping and becoming a part of the problem, rather than being, like I mentioned earlier, being subjected to punitive
measures. And one of the things that you said, and I agree, that that we are more likely to divulge statistics and information and how many times we interacted with the shark, how many times we lost a fish to a shark, because we know that that's going to help y'all make up the decision on, all right, you know, what is in danger, what is a problem, what needs to be listed, what needs to be delisted.
Exactly.
That's pretty interesting when you think about it.
Yeah, and the workshop, one of the things that also is coming out of the workshop that's evolving is, you know, because we're looking at it from the listing of the endangered species listing, was how do we keep the shark, there's two things. How do we keep the species from, you know, being downgraded to an even worse state?
Yeah, yeah.
And then what are the steps that need to be taken to delist it? And, you know, there is, we need to come up with, because we already know that biologically, the amount of this, the biomass is extremely equivocal. There's lots of uncertainty. Yeah. So we need to look at relative metrics. Like, what is the relative mortality rate that we can estimate? And that's easier to estimate than absolute abundance. And so these are things that we need, that the scientists and myself, and as well as some conservationists and then those in D.C. want to come up with some thresholds or a goal, some targets.
Yeah, and, you know, okay, let's also make, how does the fisherman get involved in that? Once again, there's going to be a need for enforcement because as soon as you start setting up things, you have to set up the way that we have to deal with it. I mean, the morality of it. And so I'm hoping that somebody listening might say, okay, I'm willing to cough up all the information I have about sharks. I want to find out, though, you know, can it be used against me? Can it be used to the point where we're going to start culling sharks or we're going to not worry about sharks? We're going to let them do whatever they want.
Yeah, and I think right now, you know, that's an important distinction, and you hit it on the head earlier on enforcement. Here in Hawaii, we are, at least in the United States and Pacific Islands, we are subjected to at-sea boardings. Our fisheries we're boarded. We have electronic monitoring, electronic reporting. We have observers. And so there's a way to keep the fishery to playing by the rules and staying within their land,
sure,
within the purview of what they're supposed to do.
That's a good point. Yeah,
and our fishermen here, even locally, you know, this is the same thing. There is a little bit of self-regulation that goes on among the fishermen, and then like you mentioned, there's a level of trust that when the fishermen are dealing with managers and scientists, we need to maintain, critical to maintain that level of trust. But going back to the enforcement issue, is we need to go to the table and make sure that internationally the other people are playing by the rules, that there is enforcement, and there is means to monitor the take of sharks. And we had a geneticist from Florida who was here, who was a fascinating guy. His name is Damian Chapman, and they've done work on monitoring the shark fin trade in Hong Kong by essentially sending people out and then using DNA techniques to identify the species and coming up with very novel approaches.
I saw that, and I thought to myself, when they went into it, they were looking for funding to expand the study so that they could be use of it. And I thought, well, okay, if you have the DNA of a shark, and I got some DNA on me because I got bitten, now, yippee, we know how it... You know, what particular shark bit me, but what value is that in there? Well, it turns out to be a lot of value.
There's a lot of value. Yeah, yeah. And just even knowing the species of shark that is involved in events and depredation events on fisheries or even on unfortunate events, interactions with humans, is very important. And getting that scientific information is valid to looking at the risk of interactions. Also, the risk, also in quantifying many means of the demand, and going back to the shark fin issue, looking at what is the overall demand and what is the supply chain of shark fins, in which is prohibited.
Yeah, and that was interesting because last week we had these two guys, Jim Borja, and the other guy was Mike Fleming. Fleming is a fisherman from Saipan, and Borja, the other guy, is from Guam. And here are guys that were thousands of miles away. Doing work with the council that was really far afield of what they did. These guys are bottom fishermen.
Right.
So by being here thousands of miles away, they're not fishing. And it just goes to show you how people are willing to contribute. And we did talk about sharks. We did talk about the number of sharks that interrupt their catching bottom fish. You know, they're bringing fish up from the bottom of the ocean. The sharks find out that they have to move sometimes.
Yeah, and I've seen more than enough photos of these beautiful onaga that have just been ripped to shreds.
Just we get the head.
And the troll fisheries have been impacted too in Guam and Saipan. You know, we were looking at a report that 40% of effort has had depredation events, which is, so 40% of every trip has a depredation event. And then even among those events, they've had catastrophic loss.
Yeah, and by the way, you can't go to another area because it's the whole area.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get to some of those places where you go from 10 feet deep to 1,000, you know, in one move, it gets to be... So the bottom line here is, so that we can get some sense of understanding, what do you say the recovery program is that's being developed right now? Talk about implementation and what sort of results you would expect to get out of a recovery program. What sort of recovery?
So the recovery plan, as I mentioned earlier, is there. So I'm going to cover three things here. First, is setting up a criterion that is both domestic and international.
Okay.
So we need to look at what rate of mortality that the species has been. We need to monitor
this. Based on history that you've got.
On catch history, yeah, and also on interactions and reported takes and reported mortality.
Okay.
Not just domestically, but internationally. Then you have domestic issues that we need to work with our fishery bottom up. We need to come up with means to help the fishermen reduce interactions, but also working on issues that crew can safely, and that's another issue on crew safety, release sharks with not having trailing gear, so therefore the mortality rate is lower. That's a main critical component that we need to work with. And then also
hooks will rust out. What you're trying to do is control the amount of leader.
And there's some terminal tackle, and there's concern also when you're cutting, when you have a big shark on, a very green animal, or even with billfish is a problem too. When you cut the line, you can have flyback, which can be extremely dangerous.
Yeah, to the fishermen. Yeah,
So there's means, and we had some fishermen and former observers come up with ideas on how to reduce that gear flyback. Mm-hmm. Even this was all on the fly. This recovery plan meeting, the fact that you had these folks talking together and coming up with ideas was very, refreshing. Yeah. So that's an issue too. And also with how do we get the fleet and our local small boat fisheries from avoiding interactions. Mm-hmm. So that's one issue. And then internationally, which is the big picture, is how do we come up with incentives to reduce the transshipment of fish products. And that's one thing I want to mention. The United States has zero transshipment. That's something to consider.
When
vessels at sea can transship from one vessel or other vessel to another. So oftentimes a lot of unreported things happen, or the transfer of certain species can kind of go under the radar.
Well, it used to be where there's the smaller boats and the mother boats.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff was going on, and the mother boat became sort of you can't come on this, and we're not telling you what's on this boat.
Well, yeah, and then things happen in other port state measures that need to come in place to prevent these type of things. And there's compliance monitoring. So we need to come up with astute measures that internationally, when we go to the table, to incentivize more enforcement, to incentivize no transshipment, to incentivize compliance monitoring and observer coverage. So the playing field is level, but also to make sure and monitor what's happening with the shark populations.
Yeah, and the thing that gets frustrating for a lot of us on that is sometimes the majority can be doing the right thing, and just a couple of bad guys can ruin the whole thing.
Exactly.
It doesn't take much to throw these things a Kindle, does it?
It does not, and we need to keep also, but when we also need to make sure, and that's a good point, is if there's bad actors out there, we need to address them and not necessarily take the low-hanging fruit, which unfortunately oftentimes is the most compliant fisheries, like the U.S. or the Hawaii fishery, which is, it's easier to regulate because they're already compliant and they have more observer coverage. So it's
okay,
something
so,
to be very
so light, light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, we've known each other for a while, and I think you're an optimist. I don't think you could really do what you do without being somewhat optimistic, because otherwise it'd be, oh my goodness, woe is me, the world is ending tomorrow. So the light at the end of the tunnel is that it seems to be that there is a fair bit of energy being expanded into a recovery program and a meaningful one.
The thing is that you also, It's like when I'm running, doing a very nasty trail hike here in Hawaii. Yeah. You go and you're looking. If you always are looking at where you need to be, but if sometimes you need to look back and look how far you've gone, gone in that short amount of time. And I think that's what we need to do, is take a very objective look on progress. And the fact that
that's a good analogy. I looked at the same thing for a second, and that is that there was that country western song, "Happiness is seeing Lubbock, Texas in my rearview mirror."
Yeah.
Well, it's like when you're driving a boat, you got to watch out a quarter of a mile in front of you. But every now and again, it's take a look back at your wake and see where you've been
and look at where you've gone. And I think that's where this optimism needs to come from. I mean, I'm not delusional here, but one thing to look into is the fact that we have a conversation on sharks now. You know, 20 years ago if you went to the commission level, you would be thrown out of the room. You have a no retention measure that has been put in place, and the fact that we're actually able to do a stock assessment on them on a non-target species is a positive.
What can they find on the WPConsul.org? Is this recovery plan going to be listed out? Can people go take a look? What's up?
I think we're still in the early stages of the recovery plan, but this information will be made public through the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Yeah. Okay, we got more coming up. Thanks very much, Mark. Nice seeing you again. And we'll see you next week. As a matter of fact, we got more coming up. And if you want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. So for everybody at POP Fishing Marine and our partners at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, go catch some fish. Have a good time. Eat what you do. And save some for the rest of us. Aloha.